Good afternoon. It's a pleasure and honor to be here with the Deputy Minister of Defense of the State of Israel, Dr. Ephraim Sneh. He has a very long and very impressive biography, but I think that in this occasion I can say something which is not written in the biography, and that he was one of the few within the politicians which understood many years ago that Iran is becoming the real threat to the existence of the State of Israel. And when we, the professionals, tried to convince many here in Israel and all around the world that it is going to happen if it will not be stopped, Dr. Ephraim Sneh was one of the very few who helped us to shape this understanding and to fight against the ignorance of the others who could not understand the real situation, which is now the main factor, to my private view, the main factor in the whole picture of the Middle East, that Iran is taking the lead and becoming a radical leader of the Middle East under nuclear umbrella. And Dr. Sneh was really one of those who understood it very early and tried to help us to stop it, and we didn't succeed up till now. Now he's in a better position to do the job, and it will be, I think, very interesting to hear his views, not from the sideline, but from the center of the decision making system of the State of Israel. Dr. Sneh, please.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Few details about Iran. Who is the president? Who is Ahmadinejad, whom we hear all the time? He belongs to a school of thought, or if you like, a sort of a sect in the Iranian religious establishment, which believe that the return of the Shiite Messiah, the vanished Imam, or the Mahdi, is supposed to happen very, very soon. More than that, he believes that he has a role, a divine role, in making this arrival very, very concrete in our lifetime, maybe even within several years. His faith, his conviction says that the Messiah, the Mahdi, will come back only as if there is a sort of Armageddon, a doomsday, a major global collision or calamity, that at the result of it, the Shiite would govern the entire globe. Very few people know about it, but this is his conviction. I didn't bring with me quotations, but everything which I said is based on quotations of Ahmadinejad. More than that, when he was the mayor of Tehran, he paved a very broad boulevard in Tehran, and the reason for the for paving this avenue was that this is the route where when the Mahdi will come, he will drive in this avenue. Very concrete preparations. He is a serious man. So we have to understand part of his actions, not only his declarations, as stemming out as a result of his messianic belief. Of course, the elimination of the Jewish state is a part or indispensable part of this doomsday which should precede the arrival of the Mahdi. More than that, he says that the Mahdi actually appointed him as the president of Iran. He advised him to run for presidency, and he made his election possible. I don't think that these details are just, you know, for your curiosity, anecdotal details, but I think that we can learn something about the way this president thinks. Now, what is the strategy? What is the real strategy of Iran? Where are they heading? As I said, they consider themselves as the rising global power, not regional power, global power. And if I have to quote Ahmadinejad, he said, "We are the rising sun, and the United States is the setting sun." This is the comparison of his. To start with, their concrete aspiration is to build a territorial contiguity of Iranian influence from the border of Afghanistan to the Mediterranean. A Shiite belt or a Iran-dominated belt from Afghanistan to the Mediterranean. And what are the bricks of this wall that they try to build? They meddle already in Afghanistan, something which they didn't do in the past, but they succeeded, even in a way, fought the Taliban, but now they changed their tactics in Western Afghanistan. Iraq, they succeeded so far to take advantage of the collapse of Saddam Hussein regime, the demise of Saddam Hussein, in order to actually build a Shiite federal state in the south, which is very clearly is under their direct influence, and in the central government of Baghdad, they infiltrated and captured several key positions, and they have a growing influence in the central government in Baghdad. Even in the Kurdish north, they meddle in their own way. And if the U.S. troops capture some high senior intelligence officers of Al-Quds force, which is the global intervention force of Iran, they were on the way to Kurdistan because they try to undermine the federal government there in order either to influence Kurdistan or at least to prevent the activity of Iranian Kurds who want more national and civil rights. Syria, they succeeded to build an alliance, a strategic alliance with Syria, and then the last step to reach the Mediterranean is Lebanon. Third of the Lebanese are Shiites, and they try by using the political power of the Shiites in Lebanon to take over the Lebanese government, to dominate it, or to paralyze it, either of the two. So this is the contiguity of Iranian domination: Iraq, Syria, Lebanon. They have another direction of expanding their influence, and this is the Gulf. They are very active in Bahrain, where 70% of the population is Shiite. They very actively undermine the government there. And most, if not all, of their naval exercises are simulation of taking over the Straits of Hormuz, where most, or the majority of the global oil flows. Their eye is on the wealth of the Gulf oil. That's why the Gulf states are terribly scared. And believe me, they have good reason. Terror. You know, now we have a sort of a ceasefire with the Palestinian organization. In Gaza, maybe in a way in the West Bank, who are the only organizations who are active now, who launch the rockets to Israel every day? The Islamic Jihad. Which organization now actively prepares suicide bombing inside Israel? Islamic Jihad. Even the Hamas is now relatively respecting the ceasefire. But the organization which every day violates the ceasefire by launching rockets to Israel, which we know prepares every day suicide bombing inside Israel, is the Islamic Jihad. Who pays 100% of the Islamic Jihad budget? Tehran. Plus a bonus for every Israeli that is killed in their operations. So they have a special incentive, and it seems to me that the only member of the United Nations who pays bonus for killing civilians is Iran. And Ambassador, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's the only one. Now, but there is another organization which takes the second place in activity, in terrorist activity these days, and this is Shuhada al-Aqsa. You may think that this is Shuhada al-Aqsa, which you know, the military wing of the Fatah. No, only by name it belongs to Fatah. Actually, they were bought by Hezbollah, which is an arm of Iran, and actually they are directed, these squads, terror squads of Shuhada al-Aqsa, they are now paid, directed, indirectly via Hezbollah, but the source of orders and money is from Tehran. So you can see that the real spoiler, the tireless spoiler of Israeli-Palestinian rapprochement is Iran. Just a reminder, the long arm of Iranian terrorism is not only here in Israel in the territories. Just to remind you, the bombing of the Israeli embassy and of the Jewish community center in Buenos Aires. And to give you just an illustration, a short story which tells you what is not only the modus operandi, but the way of thinking of this regime, and is the following story. In the 90s, I think in the early 90s, a United States frigate or destroyer, it doesn't make a difference, by mistake, by launching a ship-to-air missiles, shot down a civilian Iranian airliner. 120 innocent casualties, but it was a mistake. Years later, the wife of the commander of this ship was assassinated in a shopping mall in Los Angeles by a bomb put under her car. The method of revenge, no matter where, they reached her in the west coast of the United States, but they reached her. I said about Lebanon as one of the countries in the region that they want to take over. What is going right now in Lebanon, in Beirut, the effort to overthrow Fuad Senora's government and using Hezbollah not only as a political tool, but mainly, and we are six months after the war in Lebanon, to build Hezbollah as a major military force, which can be, in a way, even a strategic threat on Israel, given its ability to launch thousands of rockets on the Israeli towns and villages. Maybe last characteristic for this regime is the gruesome record of human rights, something which nobody in the world really cares about. But we have to bear it in mind. Let alone suppression of free press, journalists who are most of them in jail, no opposition candidate who can run for elected positions, but terrible ways of punishments in their religious courts, amputations, killing by stoning. As I said, terrible, gruesome record of so-called human rights. It's no human rights, but even the most enlightened countries in the world try to forget it. So now I go back to the title of this talk of mine, the implication of a nuclear Iran. Now imagine that this regime, the powerhouse of terrorism in the region, with ambition of expansion and domination over the entire region, if not more of that, if this regime would have the power of nuclear blackmail, how the life in this region would look like. Not only Israel, but other countries as well. That's why we believe that everything should be done in order to avoid it. And in this point, I'm stopping in order to allow your questions and hopefully my answers.
Please identify yourself before asking the question. It will help us later to understand who asked what. Okay, it will be that you will ask the question, then the deputy minister of defense will answer all the questions together at the end. So please identify yourself so we can answer your questions directly. Please.
Dan Williams from Reuters. You've understandably described a very urgent situation as far as Israel's concerned, the West, with the Iranian nuclear program. Given that it seems that open Israeli diplomacy has pretty much exhausted itself, Prime Minister Olmert just came back from finishing a tour of the nations with permanent seats on the Security Council. Resolution 1737 may come up again next month if, and everyone anticipates this will be the case, Iran continues to flout the conditions that it halt uranium enrichment. How do you see the way forward? Is Israel satisfied with Western diplomatic pressure, or will it be forced to seek an alternative? I'm also referring to the military option, not necessarily Israeli, potentially an American military option.
I'm Anne Bernard from the Boston Globe. I just wondered whether, looking at the region, there are signs that, in the long run, Arab Sunnis might be more worried about Iran than they are about Israel, and whether there's any diplomatic opportunities there for Israel to exploit.
I'm Dion Nissenbaum from the Miami Herald, and General Hariri was here last week talking about Iran's operations in Gaza, and I'm wondering if you can talk about. Well, I'm wondering if you can just talk about what concrete evidence you have that Iran is providing weapons to militant groups in Gaza.
Okay, I can shout. Good morning. Very good. I'm Eric Silver from The Independent. I wanted to ask you, how much of a limiting factor on Iran's ambitions is it that all the Shiite partners you mention, or satellites that you mention, are Arabs? How much it's important in their perception, as far as you understand it, that they are dealing and they are being sponsored by Persian Shiites? In other words, are they totally in Iran's pocket, or do they have reservations and inhibitions about how far they will go as allies or lackeys, or however you want to put it, of Iran? Can I also ask you a question outside the Iran field, but since some of us are journalists, you said yesterday, I think, that Israel has to start thinking about releasing Marwan Barghouti from prison. Can you elaborate a bit on your thinking there, the rationale for this idea? Thank you.
Yes, from the Neue Zürcher Zeitung in Switzerland, also a bit outside of the immediate subject. You were this morning in Hebron. Could you tell us a bit about your trip there, and what did the government until now not know about the behavior of the settlers towards the Palestinians?
Yes, please. Yes. If you can, to the microphone. Okay. Thank you.
I am Béla Jungbert, Hungarian representative to the Palestinian Authority. I would like to ask you, sir, in your view, how homogeneous is the Iranian political entity now? I mean, from different public and less public sources, we know that there are some evaluations that there is a kind of potential opposition against Ahmadinejad. Could the international community contribute to strengthen this possible opposition, or could we manage to create from outside some realistic changes inside Iran? Thank you.
Uh, Okay, I think that you'll begin again the last one, and then we will make another round if we will have a time.
I'm Ambassador Del Vecchio, Ambassador of Croatia, and I would like to hear your comment about what is the main purpose of President Ahmadinejad diplomatic activities, especially now in the South America.
To your question, though it took, I think, 3.5 years from the moment that the International Agency for Atomic Energy in Vienna found out that the Iranians have been cheating the world for 18 years, till the moment when the Security Council took its recent resolution, it took 3.5 years. Very, very slowly. But we still think that the international community did not say its last word. And there is now a very concrete challenge. The resolution from December 23rd or 24th, the recent resolution of the Security Council gave 60 days to Iran to stop the enrichment of the uranium, and if not, a further sanctions will be taken. Let's wait patiently till February 23rd. I assume that more or less around this date will be another expression of Iranian defiance about the nuclear issue, I mean. And then, this is a challenge for the international community. And by the way, all of them are potential victims of the same Iranian bomb. What will they do? I think that more can be done when it comes to sanctions. And I can offer two ideas. One, as you know, Iran imports 40% of its consumption of oil distillates, especially gasoline for cars. 40% embargo on the supply of gasoline and other distillates of oil to Iran can create a very serious problem to the regime. Why not to try it? Credit in the European financial markets. They are dependent on the flow of money from Europe. Credit, the service for this financial services. Why the European as well as the American banks cannot take an action? So here are two very, very simple ideas which can make a difference. And I don't speak about other options. Let's start with something which is very, very, I would say, of course, bloodless. Very clean. Very simple. If there is such embargo, do you believe that there is a shipping company in the world which would consider it worthwhile to bring gasoline to Iranian ports, and then it would not be able to enter to any of the U.S. seaports? I don't think so. So? there is no contradiction between the two. The fact that I'm afraid that nobody takes it too seriously in Europe and other, let's say mainly in Europe, doesn't mean that they shouldn't take an action. What I call upon is, wake up!
Why should they take action if they're not concerned?
Why should they? Because we are the first victim on the list, but we are not the last ones. And if you analyze the ideology of this regime, it may start with us, but we are not the last one on their list, because there they despise the entire culture which you and me share. That's the point. Because they want to undermine all the reasonable, if not to say moderate, Arab regimes, and they want to overthrow them. That's why. Because if they succeed, will be no allies to the... Because they would have of blackmail, of stifling the world as far as the flow of oil is concerned. That's why. And I hate to go to those historical analogies, but I can't resist saying that the Jews were always the first victims of evil, but they were not the last. There is no contradiction between what I said, you remember better than I do, you are younger than me, what I said a month ago in time. Yes. Generally, we are disappointed. We are disappointed. Why it should take 3.5 years? Okay, since it happened, we welcome this resolution of the UN Security Council. 60 days? Let's wait 60 days. And what next? So this is my answer to your question, how to go forward. I don't go beyond it. I offer two ideas for sanctions, which I believe can be very effective. And the target is the regime. It's not the Iranian people. It's not even the Iranian state, which we don't consider as an enemy of ours. On the contrary. But the regime is the problem. It's not the Iranian people. And I will address what our Hungarian colleague asked. I will address it later on. I would not define it as a Sunni axis. It's broader than that, and not the religion is not the common denominator for these countries. But there are two phenomena which are a source of concern to all the reasonable governments in this region. One, Iran as a growing military and nuclear power, and they have good reason to be afraid of it. And another thing, and it goes together, the precedent of a Muslim brothers democratically elected government. No one wants that it will happen at his own home. So, there is now, I would say, an alliance in creation of all those reasonable governments which think how to join hands and to forestall these two dangers. And this is, I agree with you, an opportunity for us. We have some obligation here. It will be very difficult for those countries to join hands, for sure with us, as long as there is no visible progress towards a solution of the Palestinian problem. So if we need another reason why to put an end to the conflict with the Palestinians, here is a new but very, very good reason to do it. I ask if I have proof that that Iran supplies weapons to Gaza. Of course, we had the Karine A, it's the ship which Arafat bought from directly from Tehran. But let's speak about the current reality. The arms coming from Sinai to Sinai, they come from Sudan. Who is the pusher? I don't think there is a question. Let's ask who pushed the money? Iran. That we know for sure. But the source of the weapons, as far as we know, is mainly Iran. They promised to the Hamas now $250 million. What for? Among other main issues is to buy arms and to pay to those who use it. About Eric's question about the fact they shared at arms, I didn't notice that it make any difference. The common denominator of being Shiite and the ideology, this is the real common denominator, and it is beyond the question if it is Arabs or Farsis. It doesn't make a substantial difference. What Ahmadinejad is doing in Latin America, he's looking for friends, for alliances, and he has one declared friend, which is Hugo Chavez, and he hopes to expand the relations, his relations in Latin America, from Chavez to other leaders, and I hope he would fail. I hope that other leaders in Latin America would understand who is he. And I hope that they would not go as far as Hugo Chavez dared to do. Before I address the question of the Hungarian ambassador to Palestine, I have two Palestinian questions. One is about the Barghouti, and another one is about the Hebron, my recent visit. I am coming from Hebron. I came just now from Hebron. We know the reality there is very complex. There are there like 500 settlers that the IDF is obliged to defend, but there are in this same area 35,000 Palestinians whose life are quite difficult because of that. And I believe that coexistence was possible. I believe that coexistence was possible if some of these 500 behaved in a different way. And unfortunately, they don't. They are a source of provocations. And it's the duty of our police and our judiciary system to take the proper actions against these provocateurs. The Israeli cabinet yesterday appointed a commission of ministers chaired by Amir Peretz, Minister of Defense, with Minister of Justice and Foreign Affairs Tzipi Livni, and Minister of Homeland Security Avi Dichter. And this committee of three has to find out the way to secure that the law is enforced in Hebron. And actually today, this morning, I made a fact-finding tour there, though I am familiar with Hebron for almost 23 years. I was once the governor of the West Bank, the head of the civil administration, and I have some recommendations which I will very shortly deliver to the minister. Boguti. Two facts. One, Barghouti is convicted for 5 life imprisonments for his involvement in terrorist attacks, well, which took the lives of several Israelis. This is one fact. Second fact, Marwan Barghouti is the most popular secular Palestinian leader. And what I said yesterday is that one day Israel will have to consider how long will he serve in our jail. That's exactly what I said, and that's exactly what I believe. Now I'm coming back to Iran, to your question. There is an Iranian opposition, inside as well as abroad. אפשר לחבות זה באיזושהי צורה, או זה מחבל ב... This was a shock therapy. Okay.
Now, there are no records, so you can talk free.
I can say stupid things.
Stupid, the truth.
So, there is an Iranian opposition inside as well as outside Iran. The Iranian people is not satisfied with this regime for many reasons. I mentioned the human rights, the entire domestic policy is very repressive, coming from most obscurant way of thinking. Most, I would say, medieval values. Even worse than that. And the people don't like it. 70% of the Iranians are youngsters, and they want to imitate the life of young men and women in Europe, in America. They don't like what they are obliged to do. 50% are women, and they are, by law, terribly underprivileged. There are minorities in Iran, and they are, again, underprivileged. The Kurds, the Azeris, the Baluchis. So the Iranian people is not satisfied, and they prefer to have a different regime. But they don't see any glimmer of support from outside. In July 99, the students' demonstration were brutally suppressed. It was a painful lesson for them. There was no... There was no... there was no any sign of sympathy from outside. More than that, I told you in an answer to our colleague from okay. When I replied to our colleague from Reuters, I said it took such long time that the international community reacted. The international community is so evasive and aversive of confrontation with the regime. So what is the message for the Iranian people? They see that the Western democracies prefer to court the regime rather than confront with it. So this is a discouragement. If you're asking about opposition, opposition come from the people. And the Iranian people is not seriously encouraged to take their own fate in their own hands. I will give you an example. The previous ruler of Ukraine, he was far, far less dangerous to the world than Ahmadinejad. He didn't produce a nuclear weapon. He didn't send terrorists to other countries. But there was a very clear message from the Western democracies to the Ukrainian people that if they remove or unseat that president, they will have the backing. Does the Iranian people hear such a message? I'm afraid it's not. So that's my answer to your question. I believe that the Iranian people deserve a good government. I believe that the Iranian people should not suffer from such despotic, obscurant regime. But it's their duty to decide when and how to change it. It cannot be imposed from outside.
Not to spread the question to other areas, it will be more helpful. Yes, please, Mr. Deika.
There are no mics. Well, there is, it doesn't matter.
Mr. Deputy Minister.
No, Dan, the Mr. Deputy Minister, thank you for your presentation.
How do we reconcile a certain dissonance from your words? You opened up by saying that Iran is the major spoiler of a reconciliation between the Israelis and the Palestinians, Iran being the major external source in Lebanon of instability, as well as in Gaza. If that's true, how is Israel to go about creating this reconciliation that you talked about later in your talk, in view of the fact that a number of our neighbors may be interested in perhaps cooperating in some security alliances or discussions on some level if we were to solve this problem? It just seems to me that there's a built-in problem because of Iran's position that until that problem is taken care of, very little progress can be made on the Palestinian-Israeli track.
The only way to cope with the problem that you mentioned is to be very persistent, very decisive, very diligent in our efforts to settle the conflict with the Palestinians. If we are waiting for blessing from Ahmadinejad, we can wait forever. We have to do it in spite of all their obstructive actions. That's the only answer that I can give you. And I very strongly believe in it.
Fiamma Nirenstein, in Giornale Italy.
Mr. Minister, look, on one side you look very optimistic and on the other side extremely pessimistic, so it's very hard to put the two things together.
So you send me to a shrink?
Yes, try to shrink. Try to shrink the... Yeah, okay, no. Let me explain what do I mean. I mean, you don't believe that Europe or any other country will play a positive role. For what you say, it's quite clear. You don't believe that anybody will put some deterrence in front of Iran, because this is something that actually nobody's doing. So why don't you do something like that? I mean, at least some deterrence. We don't hear about it anyhow. I understand that you cannot ask the Iranian people to make a revolution because they won't follow Israel, right? But deterrence is something that you can use. So why don't you do that?
At first, since I'm now in the psychoanalytic phase, I will explain you. I will tell you something. In this country, you don't have the privilege to be pessimistic. You should be optimistic. And optimism derives from the fact that even in very, very gloomy and dangerous and complicated circumstances, you know what to do. As long as I know exactly what to do, I'm optimist. Because I believe that my action will bear fruits. That's all. So now you have the psychological analysis or the answer to your perplexion. Am I pessimistic or optimistic? I'm optimistic in a very discouraging circumstances. Now, ask me why? And here you mentioned deterrence. I'm afraid that some people misinterpreted some of the implications of the war in Lebanon. I don't say it was a smashing victory for the IDF. But we succeeded to change the reality in South Lebanon. In the first time, the Lebanese army, after 30 years, is there till the last inch of the Lebanese territory, secures its sovereignty, not Hezbollah, not foreign militia, but the legal, legitimate Lebanese army. They are enforced by an effective international force, which is the UNIFIL, the new UNIFIL, which is different than the old UNIFIL, fortunately. The Lebanese people understand now very well what are the results that other countries turns its territory to a springboard against Israel. And if you speak about deterrence, there is no single Arab leader who dreams that his capital will look like South Beirut after the treatment of Israeli Air Force. So I think that our deterrence exists. There were flaws in our military performance. I do not deny it. More than that, we just now finished a long process of very detailed in-house investigation and debriefing about all the flaws in our performance. And we shall correct them. Most of it comes because of budgetary restraints. This army did not train, and some equipment was lacking. There was a lack of equipment and lack of training. And in this year, in 07, we are going to rectify it and to restore our strength to the level which is before 2000. We have excellent commanders, excellent soldiers, and now they will be trained again with the best equipment which money can buy and the best equipment which our scientists and engineers can produce, and we are number one. So if someone has a doubt that Israel is the strongest military force between Baku and Casablanca, we are. יעקב, יש פה באגף השמאלי. באגף השמאלי.
Please.
Chris Mitchell, CBN News. Can you comment on what effect a military strike might have on the Iranian people? Would it rally the people around the regime, or might it undermine the regime?
Terribly reluctant to discuss this option.
Okay. And one final question. What do you comment, can you comment on the role of Russia in Iranian affairs, and particularly its nuclear program?
Unfortunately, I believe against its own interests, Russia helps the Iranian with nuclear know-how, and unfortunately they provide too sophisticated arms to Syria and Iran. Russia is our friend. Russia is a member of the family of the enlightened nations. But unfortunately here, I'm sorry to say, that they supply good weapons to bad guys.
There were other two in this wing, who are the two last questions. Yes, please.
Do I need to speak to Mike?
Jatinder Sidhu from BBC Radio News. I'd like to ask you, you've described, you've painted a picture of Iran as the major strategic threat for the region, and one that, in comments attributed to you at the weekend, which you described as moderate or normal Arab nations.
I didn't say normal, I say moderate and or reasonable.
Okay, reasonable Arab nations should align themselves against. But in order to get those so-called normal states on board, you would need to renew efforts to resolve the Palestinian issue. I mean, what prospects can you see for that renewal of efforts in the shorter term to achieve the broader strategic aim of bringing security to the region?
Given my notorious optimism, I think it's feasible. I think we can embark on a new effort of negotiations with the Palestinian president, who is the only one who is authorized, as far as their constitution is concerned, to negotiate with Israel on permanent status. I believe it is a very important starting point. Before that, we have to take some measures here inside the territories in order to reduce the despair, the poverty, the suffering, which is the fertile ground for terrorism. But if what I described is feasible, yes, I strongly believe it is. Not with the Hamas, no way. But with the president, no doubt we can do it.
And with people like Marwan Barghouti?
He was already mentioned here. Yes.
And the last question, please.
I'm from the Russian embassy. My question is very short.
Now you are getting up.
Yeah, yeah. How could you comment on Sunday Times publication? And you know what I'm talking about.
Baseless. Really. But, you know, Sunday Times has to sell newspapers. But the story about error.
Yes,
nice pictures of F-15s, F-16s, but it's baseless.
Thank you very much, all of you. It was, I think, with all of us learned a lot, but at the end, we know that it is only the beginning of a long way dealing with the Iranian threat, and I hope that we will do it in a better understanding in the future than in the past. Thank you very much.